Welcome once again. This is part four of our four-part series on truth decay, why truth is under attack, why it matters, and what we can do about it. Once again, there is an 8.5 by 11 sheet coming around, which if you haven't got, we've got some extra copies here. This is a slightly expanded version of the Field Guide to Fallacies, as I was calling it. And as I said, think of this as a sort of Audubon book. You know, you can sit out in your backyard and use your little Audubon guide and identify the birds in your backyard. If you take this guide or something like it and watch television or listen to talk radio, watch television on news and commentary channels or listen to talk radio, I'm reasonably sure you will find some abundant species as described here in any random half-hour hour of talk radio or pundit television. So I give those to you for your edification. All right. Truth decay, why truth is under attack, why it matters. These are big topics. Let's pray before we begin. Gracious God, we do thank you for this time together again. We thank you for your word, which brings your truth to us. We thank you for Jesus Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. So open our hearts and minds to understanding. Help us to discern your truth and your will, and then let us live according to your will. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. What we've been doing all 4 weeks is taking some examples of contemporary public life and using them not to resolve the substance of the issues. We don't have time for that. These are big, complicated questions. So our purpose here is not to resolve the substance of these issues. Our purpose is to think about how we think about these things and how our sense of truth gets refracted by our other interests. So last week our topic was tribes and truthiness, and the claim was that the other interests that we have, various kinds of tribal loyalties, often refract the way we are able to see and think about the truth. So that's our purpose here. Our purpose is not to resolve the substance of these, but to look at some of these issues by way of reflecting on how we approach the truth when things are controversial. And that's why we're picking controversial subjects. I understand that. But there's no point in talking about how we think about the truth when we're doing 2 plus 2 equals 4. There's no controversy there. Everybody just knows that that's the truth. So the only reason that we are inclined to refract the truth according to our interests is if there's some sort of controversy, if there are conflicting interests. So that's why we're picking these topics. And I've got two of them today, two more, which will be occasions for our thinking about how we think about truth. And then I hope to conclude all of this, and maybe we'll have a little time for conversation. Maybe not, but there's a lot to say. So, two things in the news this week. The first one, not in order particularly, gerrymandering. You may know the Supreme Court considered a couple of cases regarding gerrymandering. So here's the question in the abstract. If Party A has a majority in the state legislature, should it be able to draw legislative districts as to maximize its own representation in Congress and minimize Party B's significantly out of proportion to voter registration, right? That's what gerrymandering is. If you happen to control the state legislature, in this country, most state legislatures determine the shape of congressional districts. So if you happen to be in the majority when it's time to redraw the districts, should Party A, if it happens to be a majority, be permitted to draw the districts in such a way as to maximize its own advantage and minimize the other? That's what gerrymandering means, right? And by the way, purists point out that the governor for whom gerrymandering is named actually pronounced his name Gary. But nobody says gerrymandering. So for those purists in the room who want to say, yeah, I know it should be Gary, I understand that, but nobody says that. It's gerrymandering. Okay, so I raise this question algebraically, you see? That's to say Party A and Party B for a reason, which will become clear in a moment. So here's the question. So if Party A happens to be in the majority, should it be able to draw lines in such a way as to maximize its own advantage and minimize Party B's? What would you think if you belonged to Party B? These are rhetorical questions. John?
Under broad principles, my understanding is that decisions in a democracy are made by consensus. How can you have a consensus unless you do not have equal representation of different parties?
Okay, so John's suggesting that in democracy, you're supposed to have something like a consensus, and how can you have a consensus if you don't have some kind of proportionate representation of the parties? Again, we're not going to try to resolve all these here. I'm asking you to reflect on this in the abstract for the moment, without regard to what party is doing what. Okay? So, rhetorically, if you happen to be in party B, party A is in the majority, how would you feel if they drew the lines in such a way that your party is minimized? Ted, you have a comment? Ted would dislike that. How many people would dislike that? All right, we have a strong opinion to the effect that people would dislike that. Now, here's an interesting question. Would you change your answer if you belonged to party A? Why or why not? I'm expecting fewer hands to go up. Lois?
If I were in party A, I wouldn't want to be in control. So I would like it just the way it is.
Yeah. So Lois...
I don't want to give up.
Okay, so Lois is suggesting, purely hypothetically, that if she were in Party A, and Party A had the advantage, she'd probably like that and wouldn't want to give it up, right? I'm not going to ask for show of hands here, because that would be compromising. But obviously, the way we think about these things depends, doesn't it, on whether we're in Party A or Party B. But it's an interesting to reflect on. In the abstract, if you thought you might be Party B, you probably wouldn't like it. If you thought you were Party A, you might think about it differently, but why exactly you would think about it differently is an interesting question. So, as you can imagine, these are not entirely hypothetical questions. I've posed them at first in the abstract for reasons that we'll show in a minute, because thinking about fairness and justice needs to happen in the abstract. Otherwise, we all have vested interests that refract our perceptions of truth and justice. So, let's get a little specific here just to demonstrate what the real issues are. Here are the Pennsylvania Congressional Districts 2011 to 2018. You'll notice some rather creative line drawing. The 11th district's pretty interesting there. 15th kind of stretches around a little bit. The 6th wraps around here. But the really interesting one is Pennsylvania 7th. And because it's so hard to see, we'll expand. This has been described by people who observe these things as Donald Duck kicking Goofy. Because if you look closely enough, you can see Donald Duck kicking Goofy, right? In the shape of the way these districts are drawn. Why on earth? Imagine you're the congressional representative from Pennsylvania's District 7, and this is your district, and you got to drive around to see people in this district. Imagine doing that. Why on earth can you imagine that somebody would have drawn the lines in this way? Well, here's a clue. Pennsylvania voter registration is in, as of May of this year, this comes from the official Pennsylvania Department of State Statistics, a little over 4 million registered Democrat, 3.2 million registered Republican. In Pennsylvania, about 1.2 million described as other. The Pennsylvania statistics don't break out unaffiliated, people that say, I'm not registered with a party, in the way that some states do, so they just lump that all together another. But anyway, 48% of those who are registered to vote are registered Democratic in Pennsylvania, 38% Republican. There's a Gallup poll in 2017 that asked, do you vote Republican or lean Republican? Do you vote Democrat or lean Democrat? And so Gallup's numbers came out not far from what the actual registration is. And here's the actual allocation of congressional seats from Pennsylvania, as you see. I couldn't get my PowerPoint to go blue and red, so it's like dark red and light red. But the sort of rust color red is Democratic and the brighter red is Republican. So in terms of registration, 48% to 38%, but in terms of actual representation in the Congress, it's 12 to 6 or two-thirds Republican versus one-third Democratic. And by the way, up until Connor Lamb was elected in the special election a couple months ago, it was actually 13 to 5, I'm sorry. So there's a hint as to why people might draw the districts a certain way. Now, as you may know, if you follow the news, this was controversial. Democrats, not surprisingly, said, well, this isn't fair. The congressional representation is grossly disproportionate to the voting registration. We should fix that. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said to the Pennsylvania legislature a couple months ago, yeah, this is right, you guys should fix this. So they gave them a month or two to fix it. The House came back with a couple of proposals that didn't satisfy the court. The court said, all right, we will draw the boundaries. And so they had somebody redraw the boundaries this way, which, as you can see, is a little less contortionist in the way some of the districts are drawn. Not surprisingly, the Republican leaders in the House and State Senate don't like that, so they are, as we speak, petitioning the Supreme Court for the third time. Supreme Court of the United States has already turned them down twice, but for the third time, they're going to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to get it to overturn what the state Supreme Court has done. So what you see here is a pretty clear case of Party A and Party B seeking their own advantage, right? Pennsylvania is not the only place where this happens. Here's North Carolina, for example. So their districts in 2012 to 2014. Notice again some creative line drawing. Look at this. That's District 9. Here's District 4. District 1 snakes down around here. Some pretty creative line drawing. Similarly, people have said, well, this isn't fair. This is obviously gerrymandering. So there's a proposal in North Carolina to reshape the districts to be more contiguous to county and municipal lines. Why? Well, same reason, of course. In North Carolina, 38% of the registered voters are registered Democratic, 30% Republican. By the way, last year, unaffiliated voters in North Carolina actually took over the Republican, the number of Republicans registered by a little less than 100,000. So in North Carolina, as of this month, June 16th, 38% registered Democrat, 30% Republican, 31% unaffiliated. So if you just look at Democrats and Republicans, this is the registration, doesn't add up to 100 because there are so many who are not registered with one party or the other. And again, in this case, 10 Republican and 3 Democratic representatives because North Carolina gets 13 in Congress. And a Republican legislator in North Carolina was famously quoted as saying, the only reason that the districts come out 10 to 3 is because we couldn't figure out how to make it 11 to 2. And he actually said that. You can look that up in the news. That's the truth. Now, in case anybody here is starting to be upset, Jim's picking on Republicans, let me point out this. Here's Maryland, where, look quickly here, there's also some creative line drawing. Here's the 8th district. Look at the 3rd district. Look at this. This little tiny bridge across the bottom part of 3 and the top part of 3. Two snakes around this little tiny isthmus here, and then 4 wraps around 5. In Maryland, same phenomenon, opposite parties. In Maryland, 60% Democratic registration, 28% Republican, 12% unaffiliated. So these are the Democrats. These are the Republicans in registration. This is the way the congressional delegation works out. 7 Democrats, 1 Republican. Okay? Same concept. Opposite parties. Party A, Party B. The point, of course, well, let's just ask rhetorically. This really is a rhetorical question. If this were a college course and you didn't get the answer to this right, you would probably not pass. What is the reason for gerrymandering? The truth is because people in power want to stay in power and they want to maximize their advantage, and if they're able to do it, they do that, right? I mean, that's pretty straightforward. Does the fact that both sides do it make it right? Now, for extra credit in the course, which of the fallacies in your handout would it be if the one party said, well, yeah, but they do it too? Tuquoqua, what about? You too, right? Well, you lied. Yeah, well, you lied too, right? Didn't our moms all tell us two wrongs don't make a right? Just because the other side did it, you shouldn't do it. If everybody else was jumping off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge, right? All that mom wisdom for elementary school kids, it's the tuquoqua, right? It's, well, Johnny hit me, so I hit him. No. If other people are doing it and it's wrong, it's not right if you do it. But that's the way people argue. So your logical fallacy field guide here actually can help you see what's going on in some issues in the news today. Should the method for drawing boundaries be changed? That's a rhetorical question. I have an opinion, not surprisingly, but we will move on. What are the effects of gerrymandering? Well, power is exercised largely for partisan advantage. By the way, if you didn't get the answer on the test, there you go. Partisanship then maybe will override majority public opinion. This was John's point, I take it, right? If you have less than 40% of the voter registration, but you control 66 or 77% of the delegation in Congress, then arguably your party interests will override majority public opinion. In fact, sort of by definition it will, because you're in the minority. You're seeking to do that. Now, if you're a really dedicated partisan ideologue, you'll say, well, that's okay, because we're right and they're wrong. So there should be more of us than there are of them, because those people are boneheaded and they're wrong and they have stupid ideas. So it's better that we be in charge, and even if we have to gerrymander the boundaries to make that happen, it's just better. I leave it to you to ask whether that's a defensible position from a principle of justice. Then, safe seats are challenged mainly in the primaries, and challenges, therefore, are likely to come from the party extremes. We see this in the news all the time. You follow this, right? If you've drawn the lines in such a way that only one party is likely to have their congressional representative elected in that party, then the challenges will only come to the more from the more extreme voices in that particular party, right? And this is not a hypothetical thing at all. Eric Cantor, who was the number three Republican in the House, the House of Representatives in Congress, very conservative guy, got unseated a few years ago by a challenge from the right, because he was representing a district. This is in Virginia, right? Cantor's from Virginia. He was representing a district, very conservative, but because it was a safe district for his party, the only challenge could come from even more conservative people than him. He got kicked out in the primary, and because the primary is all that counts in a safe district, he got booted from Congress. He's a number three guy on the Republican side in the Congress, which meant he was a number three guy in the majority party. So this is happening all the time. If you draw safe seats so that only one party is likely to hold that seat, then the only challenges that matter are likely to come from the extremes of that party. That has implications, because then members of Congress have little incentive to compromise. They may get to keep their seats only by appeasing the extremists, right? But if that happens, partisan gridlock follows, undermining effectiveness. That's a major reason why our Congress can't get anything done, and why the approval rating of Congress today is in the very low double digits, teens of percent. It's partly structural. People in power have built lines, and I'm not saying that one side or the other has done this. Both sides have been able to do it when they've had the power to do it. But one of the results is that if you're in Congress, what incentive do you have to compromise with the other party? Because when you go back home, your attacks are going to come from the extremes of your own party, and you're going to lose your seat if you don't appease them. So you've got much more incentive to pay attention to the most extreme voices of your party back home than you have to figure out how to get stuff done with the other party in Congress. We're living with the fruits of that right now. And then, even more important in some ways, I think, is that the democratic system appears not to work. Perceived unfairness provokes resentment and apathy. How many people do you know? Public opinion polls say this all the time. How many people do you know say, oh, the system's broken, it's not fair, it doesn't work, I give up? Well, that's a bad sign. When people in a democratic society, Republican society, Republican in the sense of electing representatives, when people in a democratic republic despair of the fairness of their system and say that it doesn't matter, then democracy is in real danger, right? So there are serious consequences of all of this. You can see why, for partisan advantage, people do it, but it has real consequences, and it's one of those situations in life where some people's immediate self-interest undermines the larger public interest, and there are lots of situations in which that's the case. Now, this is why I was originally talking about it in the abstract, Party A and Party B. This is to review. If you've been around any time, I've talked about this from time to time. Philosopher John Rawls died some years ago. He was a Harvard philosopher. Famously defined justice as fairness. And he said that a situation would be fair if any reasonable person would agree that it was fair before that person knew what part he or she played in the system. That's the key point, right? A system is fair if any reasonable person would agree that it's fair before that person knew what part he or she played in the system. So, for example, slavery would be unjust because nobody wants to be a slave. So, according to Rawls's system, if you're asking, should we set up slavery or not? But we can't tell you whether you're going to be a master or a slave. So, what do you think? I'm guessing nobody's going to vote for slavery, right? That's just Rawls' point, and it's really kind of a brilliant point. It is, if you didn't know what part you'd play in the system, how would you set the system up? This is, as we've said several times, the famous last piece of cake and the wise mother, right? If the wise mother has two children old enough to control a butter knife, and there's a last piece of cake, how do you divide up the cake? Anybody for extra credit? One kid gets the knife, the other kid takes the pick, right? And I can testify that children will derive the Euclidean rules of geometry in order to make the last piece of cake precisely even, because if I'm doing the drawing and she gets to cut it, by golly, she is not going to get a bigger piece than me, right? It's Rawls's point. If you don't know what piece of cake you're going to get, you're going to want the cake to be equal. If you don't know whether you're going to be a slave or a master, you're probably not going to vote for slavery. But the problem is people already know what part they play in the system. That's the problem. And Rawls is criticized for this, and it made for a really interesting philosophical debate for the last 40-some years. Rawls' book came out in 1971. Trouble is, people already know what part they play in the system, so what do you suppose happens? Well, if they benefit from the system, they rationalize their advantages, and if they don't benefit, then they lose faith in the system. Right? If you're party A, and you control stuff, you got all kinds of reasons for saying why party A should be able to control stuff. If you're the master, you get all kinds of reasons for saying why slavery is actually a good thing. And by the way, this is one of the books I hope to get around to writing sometime. If you read Christian literature in the South in defense of slavery in the 1840s and 50s, it's astonishing. The hermeneutical gymnastics that good white Christian Bible-believing folk will come up with to justify slavery, and, by the way, 100 years later, to justify segregation. If you benefit from the arrangement, you will rationalize your advantages. If you don't benefit, you will lose faith in the system. Then again, rhetorically for the moment, does gerrymandering meet the criteria for justice as fairness? If you didn't know if you were going to be party A or party B, if you didn't know who was going to win, would you support this given all the consequences? There's an example, a real-life example, literally ripped from the headlines because the Supreme Court had to look at that this week. By the way, they punted. They kicked the can down the road saying, well, the plaintiffs in this case didn't really have standing, which is by way of saying they don't have sufficient grounds to bring the case, but this will return to the Supreme Court later. So here's a case, literally ripped from the headlines this last week, about how people think about the truth, right? In the abstract, nobody would vote for slavery. In the abstract, most people would say, well, I probably wouldn't support gerrymandering because I could be party B and I could lose. But if you already know that you're party A and you're winning, well, you find all kinds of reasons to be for it. If you're a slave owner, you find all kinds of reasons to defend slavery, etc. All right, here's the second topic. Perhaps you've heard. There's an immigration crisis in the country, particularly now with regard to children. So, spoiler alert, this will also come up a little bit in the sermon. The administration's zero tolerance policy treats people who enter the U.S. without proper documentation as subject to more or less immediate criminal prosecution. Why does that matter? Well, because the law does not permit children to be incarcerated with adults, and various court rulings have said children may not be held for more than 20 days without being sent on to foster care or some context more suitable for children's care. And that, of course, is a very reasonable thing. You don't want kids to be in limbo for a long time. So here's the dilemma. More than 2,300 children, and by some counts it's up to 2,500 or 2,600, I don't know, but it's a lot. 2,300 children have been separated from their parents who were taken into custody since the policy was implemented, the zero tolerance policy, in April. Parents are likely to be detained for longer than 20 days. It takes a long time to get through the system, especially since it's backlogged. So it's difficult to know how long their children will be separated from them. And according to lots of reports from social workers and legal advocates and reporters, many parents don't know where their children are or when they will see them again. This is the dilemma. We're treating the parents as criminals because they have broken the law. They've committed a crime, so we're treating them as criminals. We can't incarcerate children with parents. Nobody would want to do that. And the law says we can't hold the kids for more than 20 days. So what the administration is doing is farming out these kids to foster homes and various kinds of centers, by the way, including Holy Family Institute here in Pittsburgh. I called my former colleague and friend, Sister Linda Yankoski, a couple days ago, because Holy Family, she's the head of Holy Family. Some of you know that I was the executive director of the Wesley Institute 30-some years ago, which was a kind of sister agency to Holy Family. So Sister Linda and I were sort of colleagues in the field some large number of years ago. She's still there. So they're still taking these kids. And had a really interesting conversation with Linda. She says there are lots of really, really fine social workers in DHS, all the agencies trying to take care of the kids. There's some really, really fine people. It's the policies that they don't control that are causing some of the problems. So was this necessary? Administration officials say they're simply enforcing the law. Look, you cross the border illegally, you commit a crime, we're a nation of laws, you got to enforce the law. What's the problem? I mean, this is sort of self-evident, right? We're simply enforcing the law. But neither the George W. Bush administration nor the Obama administration enforced the law in this way. They all found reasons. For the last 16 years, 8 years of Obama, 8 years of Bush before that, they found other ways to deal with children coming across the border illegally with their parents. Massive protests, as you might have heard, from religious, civil, and other organizations, and individuals from all parties. All four first ladies, as you may have heard, wrote against this policy, including Laura Bush. All kinds of Republicans, all kinds of Democrats fussing about this, civil and other organizations protesting, and that appears to be causing a change in the administration's approach, though details remain unclear. The president issued an executive order a few days ago, but the content of it is a little fuzzy, so people aren't entirely sure what that means. Was this a reasonable or effective approach to deterrence? Well, again, our purpose here is not to settle the substance of these questions. These are big, complicated issues. We can't solve those here. Our purpose here is to say when people have an interest in a situation, an economic interest, a political interest, a tribal loyalty interest, when they have an interest in the situation, they tend to think about the situation differently. And our whole purpose here is to ask, how does our approach to the truth get refracted by some of these interests? Should it? And what can we do to overcome that? So, rhetorically for the moment, was this all necessary? And by the way, for deterrence, is taking children from their parents, which a couple people in the administration have explicitly said ought to serve as a deterrent, is that a reasonable form of deterrence to keep people from committing crime? What's the impact on America's image and soft power in the world? Soft power is a concept that has gained traction in the last 30 years or so by some people at Harvard and elsewhere. That the power that a nation exerts in the world isn't just tanks and aircraft carriers and ICBMs. The power that a nation exerts in the world is also a matter of soft power, as they call it, which is to say prestige, the respect that a nation enjoys in the world, the willingness of other nations to go along because of the reputation of that nation. And what you want, of course, is to use your soft power so you don't have to use your hard power. You want nations to enter into treaties with you, to do what you want them to do because they respect you, because they think you're a decent society, because they think you're going to look out for them as well as for yourself. You want to be able to use your soft power because it's a lot less expensive and does a lot less damage than hard power. So it's a question. What's the impact on America's image in the world and soft power? That's a rhetorical question, but again, if you do not get the correct answer in my course at CMU, you'd probably get marked down for that. This is not helping America's image in the world. And what's the impact on civil discourse in America? As you know, the rhetorical temperature has been turned up very high, and people are saying all sorts of things, wild things. I'm not going to tell you everything because I do want you to stick around for the sermon, and there's a little bit in there. Now, I debated whether to put this next slide up, but I'm going to do it anyway. How do you respond to this? This is from the president's Twitter account. It was sent at 6:52 a.m. on the 19th of June, which was Tuesday, and I'm going to read it because we're doing an audio recording and people listening to the recording can't see it. Democrats are the problem. They don't care about crime and want illegal immigrants, no matter how bad they may be, to pour into and infest our country like MS-13. They can't win on their terrible policies, so they view them as potential voters. Now, I hesitated to put this up here until about 8 o'clock this morning. And I hesitated because I thought some people here would be shocked for two reasons. First, that it's a striking thing to say, and second, that the minister would actually put it up in church. I take that very seriously. And once again, our purpose here is not to debate the substance of the issues. People have different opinions. We don't have time to do that. But all month long, we've been talking about the difference between facts and opinions. We've been talking about truth and how it gets refracted, about how we're inclined to perceive claims of fact as to whether they're true or not, and how we do that in light of our own interest. This is absolutely a fact, it's an indisputable fact, that this is what the president posted at 6:52 a.m. on 19. This is just for his Twitter account. So, rhetorically, absolutely rhetorically, I'm not going to talk about the details. Is this true? Now, I'm reasonably sure that we've got, 90 people in the room here? I'm reasonably sure that there are some Republicans in the room, some Democrats in the room, probably some independents in the room. So I'm reasonably sure we got a mix. Democrats in the room, is this true? Do you not care about crime? Do you want illegal immigrants, no matter how bad they are, including MS-13, so that you can make up for your terrible policies by having these voters? Is that true? Rhetorical question. Republicans in the room, do you believe that's true? Look around the room. Some of these people, they won't tell you who they are, but some of these people are Democrats. Do you think that they want illegal immigrants, that they don't care about crime, no matter if they're like MS-13, they just have awful policies, so they want to see these people as voters? Do you think that's true? If you do think it's true, well, this is 48% of the registered voters in Pennsylvania, roughly every other registered voter that you see. Do you think, really, that's what they think? If you don't think it's true, what do you do about it? Do you give it a pass? Do you say, well, look, in politics, everybody says exaggerated things, just everybody does it, which, again, is tu quoque, right? What about them? You too. Is it just let Trump be Trump? Is it, well, yeah, but there's so many other good things. Economy's booming, we got tax cuts, we got deregulation, a lot of good stuff is happening, so we let that go. Is it that it's just better that we be in power than that they be in power? All of these are rhetorical questions. But I put this out here, again, having thought about it for a while, not so that we can discuss it here, not because we're going to resolve the issue, but because this is not a solitary example. This kind of stuff comes out a lot. If you have a Twitter account, just go follow what the president has to say. How do you think about this? How do you respond to this? Do you believe it? Do you not believe it? If you don't believe it, what do you do about it? The reason that we bring up these things is to show how when people really have a stake in the outcome, if you really want your party to prevail, that really is likely to refract how you deal with things. And if you think something is true or not, and even if you don't think it's true, what are you going to do about it? So, should we talk about these things in church? No. This is not yet the audience participation portion of the program. So let me anticipate some reasoning. I've been doing this for 40 years. I've been in churches for 40 years, except, by the way, for the 5 years when I was running a children and youth agency and the 2.5 years when I was involved in a national education standards and assessments program. So my entire adult life has been spent in church and looking after children. So I have a sense of how people think about these things in church. So, no. Should we talk about these things in church? No. One reason is political issues don't belong in church. The church should just keep quiet about that stuff, right? We don't talk about political stuff in church. Church is about religion, right? And it could be divisive, manifestly. We've got Republicans and Democrats and independents. We've got people from all different political backgrounds. Why bring up stuff that will just divide people? Just don't talk about that stuff in church. There are other better forums to discuss these matters. Look, you can talk about this where? Over dinner? with your friends, clubs you belong to. There are other places to talk about this stuff. You don't have to talk about it in church. Religion is about personal morality, spirituality, and getting to heaven. That's what Christianity is really about. Getting souls to heaven, right? Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior. That's all the church is about, getting individual souls to heaven. Everything else should be off limits. The faith of our fathers did not talk about such things. I remember, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't talk about this kind of stuff in church. And some people might leave. People are always concerned about that. You know, you don't want people to leave. You love your church. You want people to stay involved. You want the church to grow. You want people's contributions. People in church vote with their presence and their pocketbooks, by the way. Protestantism, especially in America, although Catholicism is becoming like this too. Protestantism in America is very much a market-driven phenomenon. I've talked about this in other seminars, but for those of you who might have missed that, or in the unlikely event that you forget, Protestantism in America is a very market-driven phenomenon. What I mean by that is it's entirely voluntary. People come to a Protestant church or don't come purely out of their own choice. And if you don't like what happens in church A, you get down the street to church B. And this is literally true, for example, again, to come back to a safe example, slavery, Alabama, 1854, pastor in church, in the First Baptist Church says, you know, I was talking to God yesterday, and God said slavery is a bad idea. We shouldn't be doing this because, you know, there's the great commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. There's the golden rule. You know, this is a bad idea. So he gets up and preaches this on Sunday. What happens next Sunday? Everybody goes to Second Baptist Church where the preacher says, you know what, I was talking to God yesterday and God told me slavery is not only okay, slavery is God's idea. It's right here in the Bible. Let me show you all the ways that the Bible supports slavery, right? Protestantism in America has always been market-driven. If people don't like what they hear at First Church, they go to Second Church, right? Which means there are powerful incentives for preachers to avoid the hard stuff. Powerful incentives. Don't talk about that stuff for all these reasons, because it's divisive. People want to hear about that kind of stuff. If you talk about this, they'll go down to Second Church where they don't talk about that stuff, where they just talk about Jesus and getting to heaven and how maybe even prosperity gospel. Jesus wants you to be rich. There are lots of alternatives, and people vote with their presence and with their pocketbooks, so there are enormous market pressures on Protestant preachers not to talk about the hard stuff. Trust me, been doing this for 40 years, I know. So, why are we having this seminar? Well, there are some countervailing options. Politics, the claim is that political issues don't belong in church. I would argue partisanship does not belong in church. And in fact, you could lose your 501c3 status under the IRS if you engaged in advocacy for or against a particular party or for or against a particular political candidate. Partisanship absolutely does not belong in the church. But I want to contend that the issues are unavoidable, and in that sense, politics, small p, as Aristotle talked about politics, how we live together in the polis, that's where our word comes from. The polis is the city in Greek, and so Aristotle and the gang reflected on how do we live together in the city, how do we live in the polis, that's where our word politics comes from. I want to argue that's unavoidable. When the church did not speak up about slavery or segregation or the rise of the Nazi Party or any number of other things, it's not that the church was being neutral. Silence is not necessarily neutrality. Silence sometimes is complicity. So I want to claim that absolutely we should not be partisan, but we can't avoid the issues because silence is not necessarily neutral. It could be divisive, yeah, but Christians ought to seek the truth in love, right? Isn't that what we do? Don't we gather to try to figure out what is the truth? And we all know that people have different opinions. That's why we're not trying to resolve all this stuff in our seminar. We know people have different opinions. We could talk about that sometime. But our task, isn't it, is to seek the truth in love. And both of those things are important. Love means you respect other people, you listen attentively, you try to understand why people see things differently than the way you see them. But the pursuit of truth means, nevertheless, we have to try to figure out what's really the case and what would God have us do. And so church is a place where Christians ought to seek the truth in love, and that doesn't have to be divisive. one good thing about Westminster is we've managed to talk about a lot of stuff that people have different opinions on, but do that graciously and in love because that's what Jesus calls us to do. There are other better forums to discuss these matters. I want to say, so what are they? Now think about that. Think about that. Where else can you go to talk about these big issues with moral and spiritual dimensions that are very important? Where else do you go, where else can you go, to talk about these in a spirit of seeking the truth in love, considering diverse viewpoints? Does this happen routinely in your experience?
No.
Maybe it does, but if it does, you are more fortunate than a lot of people. Lots and lots of stories about how people are afraid to get together with their extended family at Thanksgiving because some food fight is going to break out, literally at Thanksgiving maybe. But this person thinks that person thinks that. We just can't talk about those things. There are lots of opinion polls that show that Americans are more deeply divided now than they have been since people have been doing these polls because people feel they can't talk about these issues, even with their family, even with their friends. And I'm guessing almost everybody in the room knows of a situation like that. Where else can you talk about this stuff? Except in a place where we all gather in the name of Christ to seek the truth in love. We understand that people see things differently, but we're going to talk about it in a context of spiritual and moral responsibility. Then, biblical faith is about the personal and the social. Contrary to this, you'll notice, by the way, these bullets are cleverly lined opposite those bullets. Biblical faith is about the personal and the social. Just read the Bible. I'm always amazed when a certain kind of Christian says, Christianity is only about getting people to heaven. And they will call themselves Bible-believing Christians. I say, well, what parts of the Bible do you read? Because the Bible is absolutely about personal faith and devotion, yes. And it is chock full of the implications for being faithful to God for the way we live in society. We read those texts all the time here. You'll hear some more this morning in worship. So the claim that religion, or Christian religion at least, is about just personal morality, spirituality, and getting to heaven, I want to say, just say it bluntly, from a biblical perspective, that's nonsense. It's absolutely about that. Personal faith, responsibility, ultimately getting to heaven, absolutely, yes. But to claim that it's only about that is just nonsense. You can't read the prophets, you can't read Jesus, and come away thinking that what we do in the world doesn't matter to God as well. Then, the faith of our fathers didn't talk about such things. God and history judge when it did not. And I've already mentioned these. I'm an historian, as some of you know. I have a PhD in history. When historians write about the church at the time of slavery, it's not a pretty story. When they write about segregation, certainly in the South and in places that supported segregation, it's not a pretty story. One of the big questions in history is, where was the church when the Nazis were on the rise in Germany? And there was the main portion of the church called itself the German church. And they essentially capitulated to the rise of the Nazis. And a really interesting, you can get a PhD in history by writing about why the church, for the most part, was silent when the Nazis rose in Germany. People said, you know, my Jewish neighbors used to have that store, but then they got it closed. You know, well, it was closed. But, you know, people are getting employed. You know, I mean, Hitler's making jobs. The economy's better than it was. Germany was embarrassed, you know, with World War I. The Versailles settlement was an insult. Things are better now than they used to be. And, yeah, I heard rumors about my Jewish neighbors. I haven't seen them around for a while. Read the stories. It's breathtaking. And you ask, where was the church? Well, the church was silent for all these kinds of reasons on the left. And there are some famous exceptions, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a few others. And there's the famous line attributed to Martin Niemöller, the pastor, about how they came for these people and I didn't do anything. And I came to those people and I didn't do anything. They came for these people, I didn't do anything. Then they came for me and there wasn't anybody to speak up for me. I'm telling you, history, and I would argue God, does not judge kindly when the church fails to respond to injustice in the world, claiming that that's none of our business, we don't do political stuff, it's all about just getting individuals to heaven. And some people might leave. In my experience, in my experience in 40 years, yes, some people leave, but if you do this well, if you create a climate where people can talk about things in a spirit of seeking the truth in love, you respect other people's opinions, doesn't mean you agree with them, but you try to reason together, in my experience, relatively few people leave, many fewer than people fear. Quite a few people are grateful that their church will talk about these things. And even if people don't come to agreement, there are lots of people, and I would submit that Westminster is a church like this, there are lots of people who are really grateful to belong to a church where you can talk about these things, where we know people disagree, but we can do it in love and charity because we know God wants us to seek the truth in love. So I think for all these reasons on the left about why we shouldn't talk about these things, there are countervailing reasons on the right why we should. Let's land the airplane here in a couple minutes. What would Jesus have us do? You know, that's always a good question for church to ask. Well, here's Micah, arguably the one-sentence summary of an Old Testament view of what God wants. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. Remember, the Old Testament was what Jesus called the Bible. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe dill and mint and cumin. You do that religious stuff, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. That's Jesus, right? Jesus himself says that any religion that thinks it's just about putting your tithes in, bringing your herbs, your sacrifices, doing the ritual stuff, any religion that thinks that's it, misses the weightier matters, even of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. And by the way, he didn't make that up. He gets that from prophets like Isaiah. Is this the fast that I choose, to humble yourself for a day, to put on a little sackcloth and ashes? No. No, it's to care for the hungry, the poor, to do justice, right? Read Isaiah. Jesus didn't make this stuff up. He got it from Isaiah because it's all from the same word of God. And in everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. For this is the law and the prophets, Jesus. Again, what would Jesus have us do? We know the answer to that. Do justice, love kindness, seek the truth in love, practice justice, mercy, and faith. Treat other people as you would want to be treated if you're in their situation. So, this seems like a really silly question. But the fact that we have to ask it is a sign of our times. Why does truth matter? There are probably lots of reasons. Democracy depends on people knowing the truth. People of good faith can disagree on what to do about things, right? You can look at poverty, you can look at healthcare, you can look at climate change, and thoughtful, decent people can disagree on what to do about those things. But you can only have a meaningful discussion if you can have some consensus about what the facts are, right? How can you even talk about things if you can't agree about what the facts are? And the facts are what we're talking about with the truth. Remember, day one, we distinguished truth from opinion. People can have all kinds of opinions. You're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. Democracy itself depends on knowing the truth insofar as we can, coming to some kind of agreement on how do we best understand what the facts are. Then we can talk about what to do about it. Denying the ability to know the truth undermines democracy. I'm hesitant to go to DEFCON 1 on these things because people are always getting hyperbolic. They're always, you know, every bad thing is Hitler. Somebody said to me in a class that I taught a few months ago that there should be a logical fallacy called the reductio ad Hitlerum, which is this is a wonderful line. Well, yeah, Hitler did that, you know, and you should strike that out because it's the reductio ad Hitlerum. So people go to DEFCON 1 on this stuff. They're all, yeah, Hitler did that. Yes, people are always being hyperbolic and hyperventilating and all that. That's true. However, that said, the reason this series is called Truth Decay is that I cribbed the title from a RAND Corporation study, as I told you, called Truth Decay. And RAND Corporation is a very serious public policy analysis outfit. A former classmate of mine at GISPIA actually is in charge of research there now. They're very serious people. And they think that loss of commitment to the truth and this growing agnosticism about whether we can even know the truth, let alone figure out what to do about it, is fundamentally undermining the foundations of American democracy. It's as if termites have been let loose on the pillars of our society. Think about it. If people can't agree on what the facts are, How can they talk about what to do about it? And if people start saying, well, you have your truth and I have my truth, I'm party A and party A thinks this and party B thinks that, and we can never decide what the real truth is, so how can you know? Do you remember the slide, those of you that were here? Remember the slide from Jim Clapper, the former head of the Defense Intelligence, basically the whole of American of intelligence, the director of National Intelligence, said that the purpose of disinformation campaigns, which the Russians, for example, are so specialized in, Mr. Putin having been at the KGB, the purpose of disinformation isn't to convince you that what they're putting out is true. It's nice if you believe that. But the purpose is to cause you to despair of even being able to know the truth. When people throw up their hands and say, "Ah, these people say that, those people say that, how can you know what's right? I give up." Well then, Americans are punting on the responsibility of a democratic society, and I don't think it's an overstatement to ask whether this generation, by which I mean not any age group, but those of us who are alive and voting adults in this time, whether this generation is going to decide that democracy is just too much trouble. You just can't know. You know, this group says that, that group says this. Who knows what's right? We can't know. Well, the founders thought about that. They were smart people. The founders, remember, started this country having come from monarchies in Europe, and they read their classics, they read their histories of Greece and Rome, and they said, democracies or republics can only thrive if you have an educated and relatively virtuous citizenry, and by virtue they meant civic virtue, where people considered the good of the society as a whole and not just their own immediate well-being. Because they said, history shows, the history of Greece and Rome show that when people in republics or democracies stop paying attention to the larger public interest and care about their own interests, what happens eventually is society comes unglued, chaos results, people won't tolerate chaos, and they will look for some strong man, some tyrant, to reestablish order. You read that in the founders. There's this comment attributed to Franklin, who knows whether it's literally true or not, but when they came out of the convention in Philadelphia and a woman said to Franklin on the street, "So what have you done? What have you given us, Mr. Franklin?" We've given you a republic if you can keep it. And what they meant was, if we ever get to the place where people punt on the very idea of knowing that the truth can be had, and if we don't care anymore about the truth because all we care about is our partisan or tribal interests, Franklin and Madison and Jefferson and Washington and the whole gang knew that would be the beginning of the end of democracy. So this is not hyperbole. This is important stuff. We need to care about the truth because our democracy depends upon it. I do not want to be of the generation that decided democracy was just too much trouble. Problems can only be addressed effectively if we know the truth. Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, and the truth will make you free." We serve a Savior who says, "I am the truth." The truth is real. The truth ultimately is a person. The truth, who is the person, wants us to live into the truth, and the truth will free us. Free us from what? Well, that's an interesting essay question for you to take home. Free us from what? Free us from lies. Free us from complacency. Free us from self-interested tribalism. Free us from apathy. Free us from complacency to the evils around us. Free us ultimately from sin, not through our own efforts, but through Jesus, who claims to be the way, the truth, and the life. So, I leave you with that. Truth matters. It matters for lots of reasons. It is seriously under attack these days, not just the substance of particular issues, but the very idea that people can or should know the truth. That's bad for democracy. It's unfaithful to the Jesus whom we serve. That's why we talk about it in church. That's why we need to understand these things and be responsible both as Christians and as citizens. So, I'm going to stop. We have 4 minutes. Any comments? Please.
Took in two of these young girls, 4-year-old and 2-year-old, who could speak no English, and they fostered them for several months while the parents were incarcerated or getting through the system. And that's just a Christian loving approach to how we as a community can help these children in their time of need, so that we can express love to them and shelter them while they're in the system.
Yeah, thank you very much, Carol. Talking about a family member, actually, who's taken in a couple of these children, that's wonderful. That's very, very important. Christians have historically done acts of individual compassion and charity. That's hugely important, and we should never stop doing those things. All I would add to that is that while we are doing those things, we also have a responsibility to address the reasons why we need to do those things. We need to look at the systemic issues that create those kinds of problems, even as we're doing the charitable acts of love to care for them. But thank you for sharing that. Please.
Sorry. Going back to the Twitter slide, I have not used Twitter. I noticed that on that slide, 20-some thousand people forwarded and retweeted, 50-some thousand made a comment, and 109,000 plus liked the slide. Where on Twitter does it indicate how many people viewed that slide?
I don't know. Does somebody know?
On Facebook,
doesn't say.
On Facebook, it tells us, but on the Twitter, it didn't say how many people looked at it, what those impressive numbers could be as far as percentage of.
I don't know. Carolyn knows something about that. I'm on the cutting edge of 1995 when it comes to social media. I only have a Facebook account because people want me to see their grandkids. So, Carolyn, what do you know about this? Glad you asked that. I asked Linda that Friday. And what she said was, don't send money to Holy Family because they have government contracts from DHS and others to care for these kids. But they only get, for example, $75 per child for clothing. So if they were going to have the kids for any length of time, that doesn't go very far. So what Sister Linda said was, if people want to send gift cards, that's useful. And I would guess to places like Target or Walmart or Kohl's or someplace where staff could go and buy things that the children need. Don't send money because she said every dollar you send us is just going to get taken away by the government. So if you really want to help, give stuff in kind that people can use. I asked her that on Friday. So thanks for asking. And if anybody wants to do that, you can be in touch with Holy Family directly or you can bring stuff in here and we'll send gift cards over to them. Sister Linda is really good people. 30-some years ago when we were both running agencies, she was one of my favorites. She's from one of those Catholic orders that is all about compassion and caring for people, and she's been doing this work for 35 years. So I'm really pleased that Holy Family is able to help. Please, Lois.
Another thing we can do is to speak up to our senators and our congressmen.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of links everywhere telling you who they are if you don't know them, how their phone numbers are, how to get in touch, and what to say even.
Yeah. Lois is pointing out that, of course, we can be in touch with congressional representatives, congressmen, senators, and we ought to be doing that. It's just civic responsibility. That's what makes democracy work. And I would argue in a society like ours, it's also a Christian responsibility. We are responsible for what our society does. John? I'll just repeat, since not everybody can hear. John's pointing out that we should always look for evidence to support claims. There are an enormous number of fact-free assertions floating around. Do you remember the very first day, those of you that were here, we distinguished an assertion from an argument? An assertion is a truth claim that may or may not have any evidence behind it. People assert all sorts of bizarre things, always ask, so where's the evidence for this? Good. All right, last week, I almost was late for the 11 o'clock service. When I went into the sacristy, I said to Louise, it's really quiet. And she said, that's because Jim stopped playing 2 minutes ago. So I need to get upstairs. Louise isn't even here today. She's just taking a day off. So thank you so much for being here. Take a break next week and then back to the program in July. Thank you.